You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
In a week when we hear announcements of foreign oil and gas monopolies reclaiming the vast reserves of Iraq oil and gas fields, there can be no doubt about one of the major reasons for that ongoing war. Elsewhere around the globe, from Nigeria to West Papua, often indigenous peoples are resisting similar foreign efforts to displace them from their lands and livelihood, and to steal their natural resources from oil and gas to minerals. In June, a struggle of this kind in the Amazon region of Peru flashed across our TV screens, but only for a split second. The reportage was so brief you may have missed it. So we contacted Dawn Paley. She's a journalist and an editor with the Dominion paper to find out more. And Dawn joins me in the studio this morning. Hello, Dawn.
Hey, it's nice to be here.
Yes, nice to have you again. What are the basic elements of the events that climaxed in the massacre in the Peruvian Amazon?
Well, it's hard to summarize. That was basically a flashpoint. And again, people talk about 500 plus years of history of resistance to colonization. And all of that is linked to the repression that happened on June 5th. But more concretely, what was happening in the streets of Bagua, in the north of Peru, in the Amazon region near the border with Ecuador, was that hundreds and thousands of indigenous people were actually blockading, and they had been mobilizing for more than 50 days against implementing legislation of the U.S. Peru Free Trade Agreement. So the way free trade agreements work is that they're negotiated generally behind closed doors. This is a bilateral agreement between two nations, the United States and Peru. It was negotiated, signed, and then it's ratified in the U.S. It goes through Congress and is then ratified. So the U.S.-Peru agreement was ratified under Bush in 2007. And the next step for a free trade agreement is the implementing legislation, or that laws are actually changed and adjusted, because free trade agreements actually create a new legal structure and require that laws be rewritten both in the United States and in Peru. And so the protests that were happening were protests directly against the implementing legislation of the U.S.-Peru Free Trade Agreement, which essentially continued to jeopardize the right of indigenous people, peasants, farmers, people that rely on the land, that live in the land in rural areas in particular, jeopardized their right to defend their land, to have their land for themselves, and to claim a right to use it over the right of transnational corporations. So after 50 days of sustained mobilization, on June 5th, 2009, so less than a month ago, the Peruvian police basically swept into the area. Peruvian government will still only admit that 10 people were killed, but numbers coming out of people that were on the ground, reporters, is upwards of 100. Some are reporting upwards of 200 people murdered. You also had many people disappeared who have yet to resurface. And also there was a number of police killed because it basically was, you know, a shootout that ensued, or sort of like a day of fighting in Bagua. But you have examples of the police, for example, firing at people from helicopters. So not an even fight, obviously. And I think that in that case, people obviously do need to retaliate in order to save themselves. But the majority of people that were killed were indigenous protesters.
And you say it was a blockade. What was the area that they were blockading?
They were blockading roads. Mm-hmm. There was a Canadian journalist named Ben Paulus, who's from Six Nations, who was actually down there during the massacre and then just after, and he did some excellent reporting. So a lot of my information comes from Ben and from other groups in Peru, but they were basically blockading what would likely be secondary or primary roads, demanding that this legislation not be implemented.
And the implementation decrees that you mentioned that come out of the free trade agreement, then they would mean that indigenous peoples do not have control over their land against resource corporations coming in?
That's often what it is. You have things, for example, like what they talk about is locking in investment. So if you have a U.S. company or a Canadian company, because we'll also talk probably about Canada and Peru's agreement, but if you have a U.S. company who's operating in Peru and there is a free trade agreement, basically the agreement locks in the investment. So there's no possible way that the Peruvian government, after they've signed the papers, can expropriate, can raise taxes, can make demands, can require certain environmental standards. All the things that we know about NAFTA are locking in between U.S. and a third world, a majority indigenous country, which is Peru. So all of those mechanisms reduce the ability of people to defend themselves, to defend nature, to have clean water, and to enjoy their basic human rights.
What is the percentage of indigenous people in Peru?
Well, all the estimates range widely, but I checked before I came on the air, and the CIA factbook, which is of questionable worth in many ways, but as a baseline, they say it's over 45% indigenous, and I would assume that the CIA's estimate is basically on the low end of things because they do tend to want to minimize situations like that. So I would say definitely upwards of 50% indigenous people.
And what has been the effect of the massacre within Peru?
There were demonstrations in support of the people in Bagua, for example, in Lima, throughout the country. Major pressure put on Garcia. Garcia is, after Alvaro Uribe in Colombia, the U.S.'s strongest ally in Latin America and basically Central America. So when you look at it in a framework, you see Garcia working very closely with the United States, signing the free trade agreement, very right-wing type of leader, and there's been a major backlash against those policies since before the signing of the free trade agreement because Peruvians know and didn't want a free trade agreement. So there was a backlash within the country, but I do think that the government of Alan Garcia is still, they're just resting back on their laurels, unfortunately. They have agreed to temporarily rescind some of these decrees, but it is very likely that they will, try the same program again, and I think what we're going to end up seeing is just continuous uprising by people in Peru against these policies.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot more awareness in Peru about the nature of free trade than there certainly was in Canada when we signed NAFTA here.
For sure. People are very aware. I mean, the reason why these bilateral agreements are being negotiated and signed now is because they couldn't move forward with the free trade area of the Americas, which, of course, in Canada, there was the major protests in Quebec City. But those meetings were shut down. And the free trade area of the Americas was an attempt to sign one huge free trade agreement between every country in the southern hemisphere, Central America, North America. And so that was defeated. And so what the governments have then done, the Canadian government and the U.S. government being the two sort of major imperialist governments in the framework of this hemisphere, started negotiating bilateral free trade agreements with different nations. And so they can't do the umbrella one, they're doing small ones. And the people in countries in the south in particular, and Mexico obviously, are very aware of the consequences of these free trade agreements in terms of everything that we've been talking about, food sustainability, their right to alternative livelihoods, their right to determine their own future, to control their own land.
What is Canadian involvement in Peru?
It is mostly mining involvement, although there are a couple of oil and gas companies in there as well. I've worked more on the mining sector. You have major corporations and some of the world's biggest mines, like the Antamina copper mine, which is run by Vancouver's Tecumenco. You also have mines run by Barrick Gold, a lot of other large mines run by slightly smaller companies, many of them Canadian, a lot of prospecting and exploring. There's a Vancouver-based company called Dorado Gold, which is actually exploring right near the region where this violence took place. So Peru's number one export to Canada by far is gold, and most of that gold is being taken out of the ground by Canadian companies and sold up to Canada for the interests of the profits of those companies. We've had major resistance also across Peru to the introduction of heavy metal open pit mines.
Does Canada have an FTA, a free trade agreement with Peru?
Yeah, and this is the sad part of the story. I mean, this is where it gets even worse. So the massacre happened on June 5th. I mean, the whole story is sad, but in terms of looking at it from a policy or a diplomacy point of view, on June 5th, this massacre was carried out. It was actually 2 days after the Canada-Peru free trade agreement had its final reading, its third reading, in the House of Commons. So the Canadian process is, again, negotiation. The agreements are signed. At the moment they're signed, the texts are released, so then they're available to the public. Then they're read. They go through three readings in the House of Commons and three in the Senate. So 2 days after the free trade agreement between Canada and Peru passed its third reading in the House of Commons, and this is with the support of the Liberals and the Conservatives and the Bloc and the NDP voting against, you had this massacre. So I think in some ways you can almost look at the Canada-Peru free trade agreement as having been a green light to the Garcia administration, that this policy of free trade and pursuing this policy of free trade is something that will get you international support. 2 days after that free trade agreement was signed, this massacre took place. And then just a few days after the massacre took place, it was read in the Senate, and it passed all of its readings in the Senate. And the senators by that time, when it passed its third reading, I was reading the Hansard of the Senate discussion, they were well aware that this massacre had taken place, and they went ahead with the signing of the free trade agreement, or the final sort of passage of the free trade agreement. They basically approved things in the Senate. So it passed all three of its readings. And you know, the senators arguing on the discourse that free trade agreements increase human rights, increase right. democracy, all the same sort of language that you hear around places like Afghanistan, for example. So it was passed in the Senate. The last thing is royal assent, which basically just means that the governor general is going to sign it. So for all intents and purposes, yes, Canada does have a free trade agreement with Peru. And it was something that the lobby for it was primarily mining, oil, and gas companies in Canada lobbying, and the Canadian Chamber of Commerce lobbying the federal government to get their wheels in gear and negotiate a free trade agreement so that they knew that their investments in Peru would be locked in and there'd be no possibility that they would face the kind of uncertainty that they may face if they're operating in a country like Ecuador, like Bolivia, where there's no free trade agreement and the governments actually have had a little bit more wiggle room in terms of determining what's going to happen in the lands of those countries.
Now, there's been considerable activism around the Colombian free trade agreement, but not so much around the Peruvian one. Why is that difference?
I would say because, you know, one main reason is because some of the main victims, the main people killed regularly in Colombia are trade unionists that have managed to establish relationships not only with trade unionists in Canada, but also trade unionists worldwide. Colombia is a country in the world where the most trade unionists are killed every year. So that sort of institutional connection and also thinking about it in terms of like the sectors of society that you have working is like you have trade unionists who tend to be people that do have a little bit of resources and are able to do some mobilization and some lobbying and so on. And I think that the problems in Colombia are often not conceived as relating to indigenous struggles and repression of indigenous people in Colombia. It's usually just looked at through the frame of trade unionists and the violence it is against them, which is huge. But there is that element that's very similar between what we see in Peru and what happens regularly as well in Colombia. And it's just a very constant conflict in Colombia of the state and right-wing paramilitary forces clearing lands, removing indigenous people from their land, just like what we saw in Bagua, removing them from the lands so that these, you know, transnational projects can move in. And I think that in Colombia, it's partly the trade union, it's partly just the consistency of the violence, whereas Peru, it's on a more low intensity level, but certainly it still exists very much. And there was some opposition to the Canada-Peru Free Trade Agreement, mostly by large groups like Council of Canadians, for example, but not a sustained campaign. And I do feel strongly that there needs to be, it's just a very tough thing for people to adjust to. So folks are willing to go no to the FTAA, but going no to a bilateral free trade agreement between Canada, Peru, Colombia, the Andean region, Central America, mm-hmm. going through the list starts to get very long and very complex, and the whole process is very hidden, so that the process of sort of getting people mobilized and just say no to bilateral free trade agreements is obviously much more complicated to mobilize people around.
Now, the biggest piece of news coming out of Central America, Latin America last week was the coup in Honduras. Is there a free trade connection there?
There unfortunately is. And I mean, the Honduran government, as well as other governments of Central America and the Dominican Republic, recently signed the DR-CAFTA agreement with the United States. So that's the Dominican Republic Central America Free Trade Agreement, multi-party free trade agreement with the U.S. And it Manuel Zelaya, who's actually a centrist, president of Honduras, had started to make moves towards participating in some of the structures that Hugo Chavez in Venezuela had set up, like the ALBA, which is this alternative sort of free trade agreement between southern nations. And so some of those moves is basically being seen by some people as sort of him moving a little bit away from the accepted framework for a free trade partner with the U.S. And then Canada also has an agreement which is basically stalled, but it's in negotiation between Canada and what they call the Central America for Canada, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. So there's definitely this, the free trade is basically the lock on the system of neoliberalism. And of course, people in the global south are fighting that with everything they can. And so the president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, he was removed from office last Sunday in an airplane piloted by the military. He was taken to Costa Rica. This is a classic military coup d'etat. And I was actually reading the National Post. They said there is a Canadian company called Gildan Activewear, which makes, basically they have sweatshops, and they have them throughout Haiti. And they were major beneficiaries of the coup in 2004 against Aristide. And Gildan's second largest place of operations is in Honduras. And the National Post, they were quoting this financial analyst who is basically saying, you know, the coup hasn't really changed the share value of Gildan because it looks like it might actually lead to a friendlier business environment. And that is exactly what you see with this president that they've tried to put in, Micheletti. They've tried to basically say this is the free market. Again, Honduras is open for business. So the president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, the legitimate president, is expected to return back to Honduras tomorrow and reclaim his position as a democratically elected president. But you also have a lot of Canadian mining companies involved in Honduras, which in the press have basically just come out and said, we don't interfere with the political activities that are happening. But we know that's not true, because if this is a government coup where they were moving to nationalize mines, or where they were moving to actually reclaim that or stop mine expansion or whatever, you'd have an outcry from the Canadian mining sector. So their silence indicates an obvious complicity in something that they think is calculated is going to benefit them as Honduras shifts to the right with this coup government. So it's very important, I think, to denounce the coup in Honduras, and also to make the connection between people struggling in Honduras, people struggling in Peru, and also people struggling in Turtle Island and around British Columbia for, I mean, it comes down to land, the right to defend the land, the right to have clean land, clean air, clean water.
Now, as we said at the beginning, the massacre was not covered in the media. Yet, our media is filled with coverage of the resistance to the government repression in Iran. What do you make of that difference between the coverage of Iran and the coverage of Peru?
Well, I mean, it's I think something that I've read most concisely by Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman in their book Manufacturing Consent, when they wrote about how they had done very meticulous studies about coverage of, for example, Poland and El Salvador in the 1980s. Victims of repression of client states of the United States basically received no media attention whatsoever in the Western media, whereas victims of people killed by U.S. enemy, quote-unquote, states receive a lot more press time and a lot more attention in the U.S. media. And that's exactly what you see, that Peru is basically a client state. So is Colombia. So will be Honduras under Micheletti, if that ends up going forward, that coup, which I don't think it will. Whereas you have, you know, people in Venezuela, the opposition gets a huge amount of press time. If even something even close to a level of repression like what we're seeing in Peru or in Honduras actually happened, you know, in a different context, it would just be politicized in a way that, you know, people would know about it, like what happened in Iran. So I think that, you know, Chomsky, Herman, the whole book is kind of long and a little bit heavy, but that section is it makes a lot of sense, and I think it holds true. And I think Canadians need to be aware that there's also a Canadian way that these pieces of information are filtered as well.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, Dawn.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Dawn Paley. She's a journalist and editor with the Dominion Paper, which you can find online by going through a link at our website, cooperadio.org/redeye. And Dawn Paley is also part of the Vancouver Media Cooperative.